Merci beaucoup pour m'inviter ici aujourd'hui à parler mes recherches. Merci beaucoup à Abdelé. Je voudrais parler à racisme à l'université. Mais maintenant, je voudrais parler anglais parce que mon français est très mal. Okay, so I'd just like to start by discussing policy making in higher education in the UK. On the face of it, policy making paints a very positive picture. It suggests that we have significant advances in relation to racial equality in higher education and minority ethnic groups. For example, we've had the widening participation agenda, which was introduced by the new Labour government and Tony Blair. It started in 1999, but was reiterated by Tony Blair. And the widening participation agenda is hugely important because it was introduced to advance the position of minority and marginalised students into higher education. And since it was first introduced, it's shown to be highly influential and positive. In 2010, we had the Equality Act, which was introduced in the UK. The Equality Act is a very important piece of legislation. It brings together all previous legislation into one single act. And every public body is obliged to abide by the Equality Act. We've had the Athena Swan Charter, which was introduced 10 years ago in higher education to advance the position of women in STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering and maths. And again, since its introduction, it has shown to be hugely beneficial. However, my research argues that the main beneficiaries of Athena Swan have been white, middle-class women. And I will talk about that later. The Race Equality Charter was also introduced 2 years ago. The Race Equality Charter works in higher education where universities are awarded a bronze, silver or gold award. And it works on the premise that there are racial inequalities in society. So it's important to advance the position of staff and students in racial inequality. We've also had a huge increase in the numbers of black and minority ethnic students studying at higher education institutions in the UK. For example, 29% of all entrants in 2015-16 identified as black, minority and ethnic. I am aware of the complexity and problematics around the term black and minority ethnic, and also to recognise that there are differences within and between those different ethnic groups, and I'm going to talk about that later on. However, despite significant advances in policy making and an increase in the student body, inequalities continue to persist in UK higher education. And I will show you the evidence for that, but it is black groups that continue to be the most marginalised. Okay, so I thought it would be really important for you to get a demographic picture and a contextual picture of what's happening in the UK. So from the last census data tells us that BME groups make up 14% of the minority ethnic population in England and Wales, and that's based from our census. And in 15-16, 98.2% of students disclose their ethnicity, and that's how they disclose their ethnicity. 21.8%, the whole group were BME, of which 6.7% were black, 9.3% were Asian, etc., etc. And the majority were white, 78.2% were white. So what we see is the proportion of students who are BME has shown a significant increase from about 15% to about 20% a decade later. So over those 10 years, we have a significant increase. But what's really important is that it's 5.3 percentage points. And the group out of the whole BME that have shown the most significant increase are black students. So we have huge numbers of black students entering higher education. But I will show you that they continue to be the most marginalised. So, from the most recent data from 2015 to 2016, white students were more likely to receive a first or a 2-1 when they left university compared to BME students. So there is a 15.0 percentage point of a BME attainment gap between white and BME students. As I said, that there are differences within and between the category BME, and it is a problematic category. but higher proportions of Chinese, Indian and mixed students are more likely to receive a first compared to black students, and that's black African and black Caribbean. So therefore, those students, again, are the most disadvantaged in, when they leave university. So they're less likely to receive a 2-1 or a first compared to these other students. So it's also important to look at issues around intersectionality, although I haven't got the time limit, doesn't allow me to look at that in more detail today, but I do so in my book and my publications. But what's particularly interesting about this data is that the proportion of female students has also shown a significant increase within the whole of higher education. So women are more likely to make up the majority in higher education. But that isn't reflect, if you look at the statistics, that isn't reflected in the labour market and the types of jobs that they do. With the exception of research postgraduates, women make up the majority at every degree level. And the majority of part-time students are also female. However, the greatest degree attainment gap is for black and minority ethnic men compared to black and minority ethnic women, even though women make up the majority of that statistic. So now let's talk about inequality, inequality, inequality. What's particularly interesting about understanding the experiences of black and minority ethnic students is that it's important to understand that it's not just about the decisions that individuals make when they enter higher education. It's important to understand those holistically. So whilst the picture shows us and the statistics show us this, that black and minority ethnic students do achieve good A-level results, which is the equivalent of your baccalaureate, I believe, compared to white students on average, they do achieve good A-level results. So they're doing well at that particular stage. And again, there are differences within that category. However, even when they are able to achieve good grades, they are less likely to be able to apply to make the applications to selective universities such as Oxbridge or Russell Group. And the reason for that, our research suggests that when you have very bright students in state schools who are in underfunded schools, they are less likely to be encouraged or know the application process to apply, for instance, for Oxford. So if you want to apply for Oxford, the closing date is September, whereas for every other university is December. And many students and parents don't know that. Whereas if you've got mediocre children attending private schools, they are more likely to be encouraged by their teachers to apply to Oxbridge, because they have individuals in salaried positions whose main job is to train students for interviews, to train students to write essays, and to ensure that students get those grades. So it's about looking at social access to social and cultural capital. So it isn't just about what happens when students arrive at universities. And we also have new data which seems to suggest that when students do apply to these universities, they're less likely to be offered places compared to white students who have comparable A-level grades. So they have comparable A-level grades, and that's really, really important to understand how, where and how that inequality is taking place. And we did have a couple of years ago, when David Cameron was Prime Minister, he did run a blind name application process when students applied for university. Because in the UK, when you make an application for university, your name is on the form. And there's evidence to suggest that based on students' names, students are discriminated against. And there's also lots of evidence in the labour market. There's evidence to suggest that if you send your CV in with an ethnic name, you're less likely to get an interview. And if you send the same CV with a Western name, you're more likely to get an interview. And there's lots of evidence to show that. But we're also seeing that it's happening in access to elite universities. So consequently, black and minority ethnic students remain underrepresented in Russell Group and prestigious elite universities. There's also evidence to suggest that black students are more likely to drop out of university. They cite the Eurocentric curriculum, favouritism towards white students, and also examples of racism. Only this year in 2018, I Googled it last night, and I picked about 10 examples of racism that took place in universities in the UK. And that I think, is just the tip of the iceberg. One example was students at Exeter University who were subsequently expelled for using the N-word and using overt racist language towards their peers. So again, I think it's really important to look at experiences in higher education as a holistic, from a holistic perspective. And I always think that education, I believe that education is a right. Education is not a privilege. Everybody has a right to a decent education, but that doesn't happen in the UK, and I'm sure it doesn't happen in the rest of the world. For example, 6.5% of school children in the UK attend independent fee-paying schools compared to 93% who attend state schools. 55% of privately educated children progressed on to Russell Group institutions, including 6% who went to study at Oxford or Cambridge. So those figures, I think, are extremely interesting when we look at the way in which I argue that once privilege, always privilege. So advantage is awarded to those who are already in an advantageous position through access to social, economic, and financial capital, particularly in relation to class, wealth, and overwhelmingly so, as I will show today, ethnicity and how that works. And in my new book, I argue that this is based on processes of white privilege, where white groups, particular white groups, have access to social, cultural, and economic capital. Hence, education is a right and not a privilege, but it is not enacted as a right in the society in which we live. Education is translated as being a privilege for the privileged few rather than the many. So, if we look at how social mobility and access to future life chances impacts on how we contribute to a social justice society, a society that's socially just, we find that isn't the case because, as I've said, once privileged, always privileged. So patterns of inequality, if we look at the demographics and the statistics, continue from a very early age and continue after transitions into the labour market, and indeed within the labour market, if you look at pay scales, if you look at who's in the higher jobs and who are the CEOs, we see that there's huge disadvantages. So black and minority ethnic students, whilst they have continued to have higher rates of transition into doing master's degrees, which is really, really important, it's white students who have higher rates to transitions to postgraduate research and doing PhDs. And I'm going to talk about higher education in relation to staff, but this is a really important point because what it demonstrates is that in the UK, if you want to become an academic, you have to have a PhD. So what we're finding is that many black and minority ethnic students don't have access to social and financial, actually, capital, which enables them to be able to do a PhD. So many have to rely on scholarships. And so consequently, they either don't know the scholarships exist or don't have the access to the knowledge that enables them to apply for those particular scholarships. So my research finds that it's access to financial and economic capital which affects those transitions to postgraduate study, which in turn has a knock-on effect to access to the labour market and future social mobility, social life chances, and the position of individuals in relation to wealth and poverty. And there's also my own evidence and other evidence suggests that black and minority ethnic students incur an ethnic penalty in the labour market. So once they're in the labour market, they experience vast amounts of discrimination, but they're also more likely to be unemployed 6 months after they've graduated compared to white groups. However, this does vary by ethnic groups, and again, it's the black groups that continue to be the most disadvantaged. It varies by gender, and it also varies by geographical location. So if you live in the northeast, you are hugely disadvantaged than compared to if you live in the south. So let's have a look at how the student demographics translates into the staff demographics. And it's particularly interesting that on the one hand, we have this huge increase of black and minority ethnic students going to university, but this is not, and we have this fantastic policy making, which on the face of it looks really good. This is not translated to staff numbers and staff representation and demographics in higher education. So in terms of all of those individuals with known ethnicity, 8.9% of UK staff in 15-16 identified as being from a black and minority ethnic background. The proportion of staff who are UK BME has shown a significant increase, again, just as with students, but it's, the numbers are smaller and it's a slightly smaller increase. And in the same period, there's been also an increase of non-UK BME, because it's important to distinguish between UK and non-UK. However, amongst UK academic staff, only 4.2% of BME staff were in senior managerial positions. So we have 154 higher education institutions in the UK, i.e. universities, and of those, only three vice chancellors are from a black and minority ethnic background. A higher proportion of UK and non-UK BME staff are more likely to be on fixed-term contracts compared to white staff. They're underrepresented, as I've just said, at the highest contract level, but they're overrepresented at the lowest contract level, and we've only just got 1.6% of heads of institutions. A higher proportion of both UK and non-UK staff are on research-only contracts in universities compared with white staff. But white staff are more likely to be on teaching and research contracts. So there are differences within the type of contract and the type of role, which is really important when looking at those inequalities across the board. So this, I thought, this table would be very interesting just in terms of looking at the way, the spread of the different BME groups, and also in terms of who is a professor and who isn't a professor, and why that's really, really important. So we have 13,295 white professors in the UK. Only 80 of them are black, 465 Asian, 275 Chinese, etc., etc. So again, it's the black groups that are the most disadvantaged. However, the other numbers are quite small, but it's 80 for black. And of those 80, only 26 are women. So why is this happening, considering that universities are meant to be liberal and progressive? So we have an assumption, don't we, that universities are forward-thinking, they're liberal, they're inclusive, social justice is at the heart of their agenda. We have these fantastic policies in universities. So why is it that these statistics are showing us that that isn't actually the case when we look at black and minority ethnic groups? So there's a huge amount of evidence that says that racism, exclusion and marginalisation continues to exist in higher education, not just for students, but also for staff who work in higher education. There are stereotypes of different types of students that exist. White middle-class students are seen as ideal pupils, very diligent. Chinese students are seen as quiet and passive. And black and Muslim students are seen as loud, challenging, and aggressive. And my own research continues to suggest that unconscious, and indeed conscious, bias continues to exist in higher education, where there are certain expectations from students and staff from particular minority ethnic backgrounds. And I just read yesterday that there's a new piece of research that's just come out where in the UK, I'm sure you have it here, I'm not sure, we have student evaluations where students are asked to fill out questionnaires about the staff member and the courses. And there's recent evidence which suggests that black and minority ethnic staff are scored lower on those evaluations compared to white middle-class men and women in universities. Now, that's a really, really serious piece of research because it will have knock-on effects in terms of universities and who they will want to employ. The National Student Survey, which is hugely important in terms of league tables and where universities position themselves. And it is something that parents look to when they want to send their children to university because they're paying £9,250 a year. So these kind of statistics and this kind of evidence is hugely important in terms of representation at senior levels. So how do I, if you like, theorise or talk about this in my work? Well, I talk about it by exploring white privilege and how white privilege works within the white space of higher education and universities. So I'd like to go back to Peggy McIntosh's work, which I know is dated, but it's absolutely brilliant. And if you are interested in this area, I urge you to go and read Peggy McIntosh. She talked about white privilege back in the 1980s. And she said that white privilege is like an invisible rucksack you put on your back. It's invisible, but it's there. And what it does is it gives you special privileges. It gives you access to maps, passports, checkbooks, visas, clothes. It enables you to walk through customs without being stopped. It enables you to drive without being stopped. And it enables you to have certain privileges that are unspoken, because those are based on this invisibility or identity of being white and what that means. And Derek Bell's work, he talks about white privilege in relation to critical race theory, and he argues that racist hierarchical structures govern all political, economic, and social domains. Such structures allocate the privileging of whites in all arenas, including education. So education is key in how white privilege and the discourse and narrative around white privilege works and operates. In my book, I argue that in some ways it's quite simplistic to talk about white privilege. And I argue that there are different shades of whiteness. There's acceptable and non-acceptable forms of whiteness. And for example, I've done quite a lot of research on gypsies and travellers in the UK. And whilst gypsies and travellers are seen as white groups, they do not have the privileges afforded to whiteness or white middle class forms of identity and that type of white privilege. So I talk about that in relation to looking at different shades of whiteness. It is something that is very complicated in relation to how privilege itself is translated in different spaces. But I argue that the spaces in which it's translated is hugely important to how whiteness is understood. So I talked at the beginning, I painted a very positive picture of all the great policies that we've had in the UK and how important they've been. And what I want to talk about now is who benefits from what I call white policy making, and why does this white policy making not manifest in real outcomes and real changes in the UK? And again, I go back to Derek Bell, and he talks about the way, and I argue myself, the ways in which policy making, such as the Race Equality Charter and the Equality Act, universities take on these policies and feel that these policies are a good thing because it's for their own benefit. It's not for the benefit of individuals. It's because they want their university to be seen as inclusive and they want their universities to be high on the league tables. And as Bell says, whites will advance the causes of racial justice only when doing so coincides with their own self-interest. So universities are going to see that the Race Equality Charter is a good thing because it's advancing their own positioning, it's advancing their own interests, and it makes them appear as though they have diversity, equality, and inclusion at the heart of their agenda. But this is not evidenced in outcomes. And David Gilborn, my colleague, he argues that the continued promotion of policies and practices that are known to be racially divisive testifies to a tacit intentionality in the system. So it's no accident, it's intentional. And whites are the main beneficiaries of educational policy making, even though they are designed to serve the marginalised. So if you look at the US, and I do so in my new book, if you look at affirmative action, the main beneficiaries of affirmative action have been who? White women. The main beneficiaries of affirmative action have been white women. And this is a quote from my new book. As long as white identity and white privilege are not threatened, white groups are supportive of diversity and inclusion programs, such as affirmative action and the Race Equality Charter. Consequently, I argue, they can sell themselves as diverse and fair, as long as their white privilege remains intact and unthreatened. So, now, this is... when I was doing my PowerPoints for this slide, I was looking at some research that myself and a colleague had done a while back, and the wonderful work of Bonnie Silver and Foreman. And I thought to myself, you know what? There's nothing new in the racism that really we're experiencing today, post-Trump and Brexit. I looked at this research, and I thought that these two quotes were really pertinent in the troubled times. Well, I think that we live in troubled times, that we're living currently. And I'd just like to read these quotes out. Bonilla Silva and Foreman, and they did their research, this is a quote 18 years ago. A new race talk has emerged in the reproduction of white supremacy. It allows whites to appear not racist, preserve their privileged status, blame blacks for their lower status, and criticise any institutional approach, such as affirmative action, that attempts to ameliorate racial inequality. So that was 18 years ago. And the next piece of research, which I did with my colleague Dr. Myers, we looked at racism in rural schools. So we went into schools where there were very small or no numbers of black and minority ethnic students, and we looked at how racism was understood. And we found that there was a denial of racism. And when parents complained about racism in all white schools, there was this notion that actually it isn't racism, it's just like calling someone fat, so it's not discrimination at all. So this was just after McPherson, which was the McPherson report was a hugely important piece of legislation in the UK, which talked about institutional racism. And at that time, there was a notion that we'd dealt with racism, we've moved on. So I'd just like to read the quote from our research. To argue that post-McPherson has resulted in a post-racial society, we argue, is utterly absurd. Such discourses serve only to further disadvantage and marginalise black and minority ethnic communities. Racism, we argue, exists at every level of society. It permeates our schools, our colleges, and our universities. It is alive in all elements of our society, our popular culture, our media, and the social spaces that we occupy. And we did that research back in 2011, but I would argue that that quote is relevant today in 2018. Am I doing okay for time? Yeah. So what I'd like to do now is, so I've shown you the evidence and I've shown you the data and I've shown you how I try to attempt to explain such inequalities. Now I'd like to give you an example of a research project that again shows everything that I've just said. That was funded by the Equality Challenge Unit, and it was done just before Brexit, and that's really important, just before the UK voted for Brexit. So there's anecdotal evidence at the time to suggest that black and minority ethnic academics were leaving the UK for overseas higher education migration. So they were very unhappy with higher education. So we were asked to carry out this study, the first of its kind. That there was no other research to show this. There was only anecdotal evidence. So we wanted to understand the reasons for overseas HU migration, whether there were ethnic differences, the push and pull factors which contributed to this, and to understand that if it was happening, what could the UK do to keep this talent that they were losing? We carried out a questionnaire survey to all the higher education institutions in the UK, so it was a big survey. We analysed it using SPSS data quantitatively. We also conducted 41 in-depth interviews with 14 academics who were in the UK, 12 who had worked previously overseas, and 15 who were actually based overseas. And we analysed that data using NVivo, which is a statistical package. So we sent this survey out to all higher education institutions. How many responses do you think we got from the survey? One, two, ten? Anybody? Half. Okay, we got 1,200. Which is pretty good, because I was kind of expecting about 200. So we were really, really pleased, because it was about exploring BME experiences. We felt as though perhaps the responses were low. So we had a fantastic response rate, which was great, and we had a response rate where we could actually run some good statistical inferences and actually make claims from our data. So that's just the spread of our sample, which was really interesting. One of the things that I'm still baffled about is the last identification, which was where we had 74% who were in old or traditional universities and only 21% in post-1992. Post-1992 universities tend not to be very high in the league tables. They don't have a lot of research time, and they became universities in 1992, whereas the old universities are the traditional universities that have been around since the 1950s and 60s. So those numbers were low. When we knew those numbers were low, we sent out more emails and said, well, can you please fill in this survey questionnaire? And we still didn't get a good response, because my hunch is that there are differences by different types of universities. But because we had quite a low response rate on that, it was disappointing. So what did we find? We found that BME academics were more likely to consider a move overseas. Yes, as our hypothesis predicted. The USA was the most desired destination. Arab, Jewish, Hispanic, Latin, and other groups were most likely to want to move to Europe. And the biggest deciding factor was the offer of a full-time permanent job, because many of the academics we spoke to didn't have permanent jobs. I'm going to have to rush a little bit because I've only got 5 minutes. Okay, the positive elements of UK higher education was that people felt they had a good job, they had a permanent job, they had a good pension. They did say, actually, that they were treated with equity. Contrary to what we felt, they said that they were treated fairly and that equal opportunities was considered important. It was a cooperative working environment, but the thing that came out tops was family-friendly policies. All carers, men, women, said that it was great. They could drop their children off to school and they could come back and pick their kids up. Family-friendly policies featured quite highly. However, many of our BME academics did feel as though they had to be twice as good as their white colleagues to get promoted, particularly to be promoted to professor. They did feel that they were disadvantaged. The goalposts were constantly moved. There was a lack of transparency in terms of it was about a network, what I call a network of knowns. It's who you know that gets you promoted, that gets you a journal article, etc., rather than what you achieve yourself. And they also felt that they felt invisible, or they were not expected to be in the white space of the academy. That was reserved for whites only. There was this notion that I think it was mainly at level six, which is just before professor, so it's reader or senior lecturer, that many of the black and minority ethnic academics felt that their career hit the buffers then, so it was very difficult for them to get promoted to professor. So prospects were seen as an illusion. And there was a lack of transparency in terms of what they needed to do, particularly in relation to how many journal articles they had to publish, how much money they had to bring in, how their teaching was, etc. And they felt that they were judged much more harshly compared to their white colleagues. So white colleagues were getting promoted compared to black colleagues who had who probably had just as much as them. So there were unconscious processes or conscious processes of racism. Okay, I'm going to have to rush through this now because I haven't got much time. So the pull factors were people wanted to work overseas. The USA was the most desired destination, although this was pre-Trump and pre-Brexit, so I'm not sure whether that would still be the case. And there was there's considered to be a black academic elite in the US compared to the UK, and I'll let you read the rest. And lifestyle was considered to be another factor, particularly culture. The different cultures of academia were considered to be very different. Travel, learning a different language, etc. Okay, so really quickly, because I haven't got much time. So, okay, so these are the factors. This is the way that the situation is. What should we be doing? So I have some bold recommendations there that are in my book and also in a project that I've just finished. So I suggest we have greater visibility of BME staff. We need to have a target system for BME staff in senior decision-making roles. We need mandatory unconscious bias training for those on recruitment and promotion panels. And we need a target system for students attending elite and Russell Group universities, and they should be supported to do this. We need to link funding to the Race Equality Charter, because the Athena Swan Charter is linked to funding. And because it's linked to funding, there's a huge number of universities that have been signed up to it. So my view is if the Race Equality Charter is linked to funding, that would significantly increase what universities are saying about race. The government needs to wake up and have national policies around these issues. And lastly, but by no means leastly, higher education institutions need to acknowledge and address institutional racism and white privilege. How does this impact on staff and students? Because a failure to acknowledge results in a failure to act. That's really important. And finally, final slide. Forgive me, I have to read this. So I couldn't really do a keynote, could I, without mentioning Brexit or Trump. Okay, so I argue that the biggest risk post-Brexit and post-Trump to higher education is the attack on a social justice agenda. We know that Brexit was based on a discourse that blamed the other and the outsider. And we know that immigration and fear of the other was used as a main reason for Brexit and indeed Trump's victory. But I argue that this discourse is not only wrong, but it seriously threatens the sustainability and future of higher education as being an agent of change, because that's what I believe it is. We as educators, all of us, have a moral responsibility to question and challenge what the rise of the far right, Brexit and Trump means for a socially just society, particularly in relation to funding priorities, a competitive research market, and the future viability and sustainability of higher education as a movement of change and a contributor to a social justice agenda. I argue that we are confronted with very serious complexities in a very fluid, unpredictable political and social climate. This climate is marred by risk, insecurity, and indeed fragility, and we know not who we are or where we stand. However, as educators, we must stand firm in our fight to advocate the richness and diversity that internationalisation brings to our education system, because it is a strength rather than a weakness. And as educators, we must continue to fight for an educational agenda that centres social justice at its heart, that centres inclusion and diversity at its heart. And I argue that we refute the claim from Theresa May, my Prime Minister, that if you believe you are a citizen of the world, you are a citizen of nowhere. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Jean-Pierre Raoult. I'm a member of the French National Commission for Human Rights. And I was very much interested by your talk, which was very rich from a statistical point of view, and very interesting in all your comments, and for instance on your consultations about old and new racism, which is one of the topics on which we work inside our Commission for Human Rights. And my question is, I noticed that the figures you presented about the situation at the university for BME students were not so bad up to the master's degree, and suddenly then decreasing tremendously at the postgraduate level. And so my question is, what is really your expectation about the possibilities of improvement in this respect, and considering the possibility of enforcement of your race equality charter? Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. It was very interesting for me. You mentioned gypsies and travelers people.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting because you said that there are white people, and myself, Romani girl, Romanian and French citizen, and I never really considered me as a white, and the others never considered me neither as a white girl. And I was really interested because in your figures, there is no mention about gypsy, Romani people, travelers, and I would like to know if they are integrated in the others or in the white people, and if you have an idea about if they have access to higher education, because in France here we have great difficulties for the children to access to the primary school.
Yeah.
Romani children in France, and I know also there are difficulties in other countries. So we're even not thinking about university. So I would like to have your point of view on that. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much for both of those questions. They're really brilliant, excellent questions, so I appreciate those. So in response to the first question, what things can we do for improvement, and particularly in relation to the Race Equality Charter? Well, I think that what we need to do is identify these young kids that are living in, black kids, minority kids, who are living in poor areas. They need to be identified, and if they're on track to get 3 A's to go to university, they need to be supported. They need to be given bursaries so that they can go to Oxford, so that they can go to Cambridge, because that is access to social and economic capital that holds them back, because they don't want to take out loans for the fees. So I think the government should be giving bursaries, because they do it in Harvard, they do it in Yale, they do it successfully. 60% of kids that go to Harvard are on bursaries, and they're from marginalised backgrounds. That's the first thing I think we need to do in the UK. The second thing, in relation to the Race Equality Charter Mark, when the Athena Swan Charter Mark, when it was announced that universities would not receive funding unless they were signed up to the Athena Swan, the number of applications hugely increased. So it has to be tied to funding, because otherwise universities won't do anything. So money doesn't talk, money screams. So if it's related to money, I think it will make a difference. But at the same time, I'm a bit dubious about it, because then I don't want it to be a tick box exercise. So we've ticked the box and we've just dealt with that. Has that answered your question?
Thank you.
Yeah. And thank you for the question about gypsies and travellers. So a couple of things there. First of all, my research on gypsies and travellers is in England, and all the gypsies and travellers I've spoken to do identify as white groups, firstly. And I recognise that it's a very complex term, and mainly the gypsies that we spoke to, English, Scottish, Welsh and Irish travellers, so they identify as gypsies and travellers. Secondly, in terms of, I have got some statistics in my book, but there are very, very low numbers. That they're so tiny that you can't say anything about them. I have looked at the statistics for gypsy, Roma and traveller children. And as you say, it's exactly the same in the UK. Access to primary school is very, very difficult for them. And when they're in primary school and secondary school, they experience so much racism that their parents take them out of school and home educate them, or decide that they're not going to school. And they are, in fact, the lowest group even under the black groups that perform for GCSEs. So that's the exam, the public exams at 16. And there is small numbers that are transitioning into higher education, but the numbers are so tiny that it's difficult to tell a story. Does that make sense? Because Gypsy, Roma and Traveller groups do not disclose their identity. They're very scared to say that they are Gypsy, Roma or Traveller for fear of racism. And I found that in, I mean, I've been researching Travellers for many, many years, and that is absolutely the case, because they experience so much racism.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.